It's really a privilege and an honor to have him here from Ireland. We've been anticipating the things that he would share with us this evening. And I'm particularly interested in all of the four ministers that had a decisive role in the formation of the state, but particularly the fourth one, because he's the founder of the organization that, for that reason, I'm here to this day, William Hull. And so we're anxious to hear what he has to say. And without any further ado, we'll call on him to speak from his heart to us.
Actually, I'm speaking from my notes, but it's also from the heart. May I start, ladies and gentlemen, by adding my voice to the sense of outrage at what happened here recently, and my thoughts are with you. Ladies and gentlemen, you might be curious as to why a Jewish Israeli living in Ireland, second-generation Holocaust survivor, would be interested in Christians who support Israel. As a member of the Holocaust Memorial Day Committee in Ireland, I became more aware of the role of righteous Christians in the Holocaust. Another reason is I have met Christians in Ireland, such as the Irish branch of the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem, who bravely withstand the tide of public opinion in order to champion Israel's right to exist and thrive. But the most important factor lies in the historical research I undertook while writing The Vow. The Vow is the story of how my teenage parents escaped from Nazi Germany. My dad was rescued by the Kinder Transport program that took him to safety on a farm school on the Scottish estate of Lord Balfour. Yes, that Lord Balfour. After joining the British Army in 1944, that's after he refused to join the Polish Army that tried to recruit him because he was technically a Polish citizen, even though he was born in Berlin, but he refused to fight even for an Allied army that was so anti-Semitic. He eventually joined the British Army in 1944, and he tried to join the Jewish Brigade. This was an all-Jewish British Army unit about which I knew very little. His unit, actually, his own unit, wouldn't release him, so he never did join the Jewish Brigade. But as soon as I finished writing The Vow, I did some deeper digging, and I discovered that to understand how and why there was a Jewish Brigade in World War II, you had to go back to World War I. For the Jews in Palestine, the year 1917 saw three momentous events. One, the formation of the first Jewish military unit, fully military unit, I'll explain what I mean later, for almost 2,000 years, called the Jewish Legion. The second event, of course, was the Balfour Declaration, and the third event was the liberation of Jerusalem from the Turks by the British. Two Russian Jews were the driving force behind the formation of the Jewish Legion and its predecessor, the Zion Mule Corps, during World War I. One of them was the journalist Ze'ev Jabotinsky, and the other one was a war hero of the Russian-Japanese War, Joseph Trumpeldor. But the officer appointed to command both the Zion Mule Corps and the Jewish Legion was a Christian and an Irish Christian to boot. Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson became one of three Christian British Army officers, the others were Ord Wingate and Richard Meinertshagen, who featured in my next book, called Six Officers, Two Lions, and 750 Mules. The three I've mentioned are three of the six officers. The other three officers were the Jewish British Army officers, Jabotinsky, who I've mentioned, Trumpeldor, who I've mentioned, and a third one called Elazar Margolin, who most people don't know much about. But the six of them together achieved or added a critical military dimension to the political battle for achieving the goals of Zionism. The two lions are connected with John Henry Patterson, and if I get a chance, I'd be very happy to talk about Patterson to you another time. And the 750 mules were the 750 mules who went to Gallipoli with the Zion Mule Corps, hence Mule Corps. For my next book, and that's the subject of this evening, God's Little Errand Boys, I turned from Christian soldiers who helped the Jews to Christian clergymen and agriculturalists who helped the Jews. And allow me to quote from the postscript of this book. In a world where the term Christian Zionist has become a political weapon in the hands of many of Israel's enemies, it is important to tell the story of the Christians who helped make the state of Israel a reality. I believe, this is still, I'm quoting, that the Jewish world is duty-bound to honor these Christian heroes. So much for the background. Three key documents helped shape modern Zionist history. The first one, many people will have heard of it, it's Theodor Herzl's blueprint for the Jewish state called Der Judenstaat, published in 1896. Second document is the 1917 Balfour Declaration, issued by the British government, which promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And the third document, of course, is Israel's 1948 Declaration of Independence, the fulfillment of the Zionist dream. We could add a fourth document, the notorious 1939 British White Paper that severely limited the immigration of Jews to Palestine and that effectively negated the spirit of the Balfour Declaration. This evening, I want to focus on a couple of other key documents and to show how these documents were critically influenced by four Christian clergymen. During the 18th and 19th centuries, on both sides of the Atlantic, in Britain as well as in the USA, many Christians were calling for the restoration of the Jews to their ancient land. In England, for example, Lord Shaftesbury was regarded as one of the prominent British champions. Abraham Lincoln wrote in 1863, "Restoring the Jews to their homeland is a noble dream shared by many Americans." It is time to introduce the first of my four clergymen, the Reverend William Blackstone. Inspired by his visit to the Jewish agricultural colonies in Palestine in 1889, and very concerned for the fate of Jews suffering from state-sponsored anti-Semitism in Russia, he organized a conference in Chicago in 1890 called the Conference on the Past, Present and Future of Israel. This may well have been the very first conference attended by both rabbis and Christian clergymen. And the following resolution was passed. The President of the United States is to be petitioned on the propriety of calling an international conference to consider the condition of the Jews in modern nations and the possibility of opening a way for their restoration to Palestine. After the conference, Blackstone wrote directly to President Harrison. His letter, called Palestine for the Jews, dated February 1891, is known to posterity as the Blackstone Memorial, and it was signed by 413 prominent citizens, including John D. Rockefeller, the Chief Justice of the United States, senators, archbishops, congressmen, editors, and publishers. And here is an excerpt from the Blackstone Memorial. Why not give Palestine back to the Jews again? According to God's distribution of nations, it is their home, an inalienable possession from which they were expelled by force. Under their cultivation, it was a remarkably fruitful land, sustaining millions of Israelites who industriously tilled its hillsides and valleys. They were agriculturalists and producers, as well as a nation of great commercial importance, the center of civilization and religion. Let us now restore them to the land of which they were so cruelly despoiled by our Roman ancestors. To this end, we respectfully petition the President of the United States and the Secretary of State to hold an international conference to consider the condition of the Israelites and their claims to Palestine as their ancient home. A very powerful document. May I remind you that the Blackstone Memorial predated Herzl's Der Judenstaat by 4 years. Now, Herzl had never heard of Blackstone, but as soon as Blackstone read Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, he sent Herzl a Bible in which he underlined every single verse in the Bible relating to the land of Israel as the only viable homeland for the Jews, just in case Herzl had ideas about any other territory in the world. As we know, he did for a very short time, but thankfully we're not having this conversation in Uganda. We will return to Blackstone shortly. I want to stay with Herzl. Herzl was the assimilated Viennese Jewish journalist covering the Paris trial of Captain Alfred Dreyfus, who was falsely accused and convicted of spying on behalf of Germany. Did anyone here read The Hare with the Amber Eyes? Anyone read it? No one read it? I highly recommend it. It's a sort of autobiographical novel. Just came out not too long ago. And apart from being beautifully written, it contains the best description, better than any textbook I've ever read, of the anti-Semitism that gripped France at the end of the 19th century. It is actually frightening. Herzl was traumatized by the baying, jeering mob in Paris calling death to the Jews. He was forced to acknowledge that no amount of assimilation would make anti-Semitism go away, so he sat down and wrote Der Judenstaat. It is time to introduce our second clergyman, an Indian-born British clergyman of German origin. How's that for a hodgepodge? Reverend William Heschler. In 1884, he published an essay called The Return of the Jews to the Land of Israel in Accordance with the Prophets. In 1885, Heschler was appointed chaplain to the British Embassy in Vienna. In his home, he constructed a scale model of the Jewish temple that had stood in Jerusalem. And when Heschler was out for a walk and he passed the bookstore and he found a copy of Der Judenstaat in Vienna, he dashed round unannounced, and I want you to understand the implications of turning up anywhere unannounced in 1896, and he landed on Herzl's doorstep. Here is Herzl's diary entry for March the 10th, 1896. The Reverend William H. Heschler, chaplain to the British Embassy in Vienna, called on me. A likable, sensitive man, with a long grey beard of a prophet, he waxed enthusiastic over my solution. He, too, regards my movement as a prophetic crisis, one he foretold 2 years ago. Heschler was very much into foretelling future events, and he had said that something momentous was going to happen regarding the Jews in 1896, but he'd said that 2 years earlier. Herzl, tall, impressive, confident, if not naive, and grossly inexperienced in international politics and relations, already looked and behaved like the mesmerizing leader he would evolve into. But he had a dilemma. He totally lacked legitimacy in the eyes of Jews and Gentiles alike. The diary entry continues. Next we came, this is Herzl, to the heart of the business. I said to him, I must put myself into direct and publicly known relations with responsible or non-responsible rulers. I think quite funny. That is, with a minister of state or a prince. Then the Jews will believe in me and follow me. And the most suitable personage would be the German Kaiser. The German Kaiser? Says Heschler. I know him. How could you know the German Kaiser? Asked Herzl. Well, Heschler had been tutor to the children of the Grand Duke of Baden and had met the children's cousin, now Kaiser Wilhelm III. So while Heschler set about engineering a meeting between Herzl and the Kaiser, he helped Herzl organize the first World Zionist Congress in Basel in August 1897. There were only two Gentiles at that conference. One of them was Heschler, and the other one was Henri Dunant, later to receive the first ever Nobel Peace Prize for initiating both the Geneva Convention and founding the International Red Cross Movement. And Herzl coined a new term for his two friends. He called them Christian Zionists. It's the first time the term ever appears. Heschler's attempts to arrange a meeting between Herzl and the Kaiser eventually bear fruit. In 1898, on his way to Jerusalem to rededicate Christchurch, the Kaiser visited Turkey, and he granted Herzl a private audience in Constantinople. But the two met again outside Mikveh Yisrael, here. When the Kaiser made a brief stop on his way to Jerusalem, he openly and publicly greeted Herzl. Incidentally, Elazar Margolin, who I mentioned earlier, one of the six officers in my book, later the first Jewish military governor of a town in the Holy Land for almost two millennia, was part of the honor guard that welcomed Herzl in Mikveh Yisrael. 4 days after this second meeting, Herzl and the Kaiser meet again officially just outside Jerusalem. But Herzl emerges from the meeting bitterly disappointed, because he understands that despite all the build-up and all the preparations, the Kaiser will not espouse the Zionist cause. He will not take on the Zionist cause, and of course we can understand partly why he'd just been pallying up with the Sultan of Turkey, and so he wasn't going to start encroaching on internal Ottoman affairs. Herzl was convinced he'd failed. But the world media saw things very differently. The Daily Mail, the British Daily Mail, reported that this was the first ever public acknowledgement by a major European power of Herzl as the leader of the world Zionist movement. Herzl had wanted legitimacy. Heschler had delivered it. Shortly after Herzl's tragically young death, early death in 1904, Heschler used his contacts to effect a pivotal meeting between British Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann and British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour. Which brings us neatly back to our friend Blackstone. Back in 1891, the Blackstone Memorial had no short-term impact on American policy. Blackstone himself continued to agitate for restoration of the Jews in their land, to their land. And then in the middle of the First World War, the Blackstone Memorial is resurrected at the initiative of American Jews. December 1915, almost 2 years before the Balfour Declaration, American Zionist leader Louis Brandeis gets word that Chaim Weizmann in England is trying to persuade the British government to make a declaration in favor of Jewish settlement in Palestine once the Turks have been defeated. Brandeis decided to use the Blackstone Memorial to help Weizmann. In a scene somewhat reminiscent of the Purim story that Jews will read this week, where Achashverosh asks how Mordechai was rewarded for foiling the Bigtan and Teresh assassination plot, Brandeis wrote to the U.S. Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, inquiring what action had been taken on the memorial. 3 months after the State Department claimed that the memorial had mysteriously gone AWOL, Brandeis was confirmed as the first Jewish American to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. he used his newfound power and leverage to urge Blackstone to update and re-present the Blackstone Memorial to President Wilson. Brandeis wrote to Blackstone, "That document, antedating as it did Theodore Herzl's own participation in the Zionist movement, is destined to become of historical significance, and I trust that you may be as successful in securing support for this new memorial as you were a quarter of a century ago." Among the signatories in the new 1916 memorial was the Presbyterian Church. This is of especial significance because President Wilson's father was a Presbyterian clergyman. Now, the new memorial was never formally or publicly presented to the president, but we know he received copies from various quarters, including Blackstone himself, who got so fed up with being told by Brandeis, "Wait, it's not the time yet." He said, "Well, I'm going to do it anyway." So we know that Wilson got that copy and other copies. September 1917. The Balfour Declaration is hanging in the balance. Most history books fail to mention that Lloyd George's British War Cabinet demanded a statement of support from the Americans before issuing the declaration. I certainly didn't know this until a very short time ago. On October the 16th, 1917, Colonel Mandell House, acting on behalf of President Wilson, sends a cable to the British government pledging America's support for the proposed declaration. "P.S.," said the telegram, "don't tell anybody." But that didn't matter. The British government had received the support they needed. Brandeis and Wilson and Brandeis, for their own reasons, didn't want this made public yet, so that it wouldn't seem as if there was Jewish influence on British policy coming from America. The historian Paul Merkley, I hope I've pronounced his name right, writes, "While it would be reckless to claim that we can trace a clear line of cause and effect from Blackstone's memorial of 1891, to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, it is not at all far-fetched to say that the memorial is the place to go to find the clearest expression of the motivation that won over President Woodrow Wilson." So we've now seen how Blackstone influenced the Balfour Declaration, and we've seen how Heschler helped to legitimize Herzl. We now come to our third clergyman. In the immediate aftermath of World War II in Europe and the Holocaust, August 1945, President Truman called on Britain's newly elected Attlee government to grant 100,000 additional Palestine immigration certificates for Jews in the displaced person camps in Europe. A shocked Attlee stalled for time and eventually agreed to what is known as the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry on Palestine. The committee issued its report in April 1946. They called for a bi-national Arab-Jewish state, not two separate states, but they also called for the immediate issuing of 100,000 certificates. Ignoring the binational state and all the other clauses and recommendations, Truman publicly demanded the immediate issuing of 100,000 certificates. And although Britain, Bevin, the Foreign Secretary, had promised that he would follow all the recommendations of this report, in February 1947, he hands back the British mandate in Palestine to the United Nations. Says, "Now this is your problem, not ours anymore. We don't want the mandate, you decide." The United Nations, the newly formed United Nations, forms UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, with representatives from Australia, Canada, Czechoslovakia, India, Guatemala, Iran, the Netherlands, Peru, Sweden, Uruguay, and Yugoslavia. And their task was to prepare a report on the feasibility of partition into a Jewish and Arab state. And the UNSCOP report would determine the fate of Zionist aspirations in Palestine. But since most of the UNSCOP members were against an independent Jewish state, the chances of a UN vote in favor of partition, in other words, in favor of a Jewish state, seemed slim. And then a miracle happened. UNSCOP recommended partition. In other words, they recommended the establishment of separate Jewish and Arab states. Golda Meir knew exactly who tipped the balance on this committee. This is what she said. "The testimony and advocacy of this man for the creation of the Jewish state fundamentally and positively changed United Nations support for the creation of Israel." And who was this man? He was Reverend John Stanley Grauel. G-R-A-U-E-L. Reverend Grauel, I hope I have pronounced your name properly. Distressed by Nazi treatment of the Jews, Grauel had become executive director in 1943 of the Philadelphia office of the American Christian Palestine Committee. But he also joined the Haganah. And he met Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, and Teddy Kollek on their visits to America after the war. February 1947, Grauel is asked to report as a crewman to a steamship in Baltimore Harbor called President Warfield, named after S. Davis Warfield, who had founded the Warfield Shipping Company. And if the name Warfield rings a bell, his niece was Wallis Warfield Simpson, that woman, the Duchess of Windsor. Now, you know this steamship by a different name, and here's the hint. Na da da da, God gave this land to me. The theme from Exodus. A ceremony was held on board. Each crew member received a Bible, Old Testament for everyone else, and someone was thoughtful enough to produce a New Testament for Grauel, and they all recited the Haganah oath. Grauel also secured an appointment as foreign correspondent of the Churchman, an evangelical Anglican academic journal published by the Church Society. So as an accredited journalist, it meant that Grauel would have a privileged status once the ship reached Palestine. July 1947, the Warfield, designed to transport 650 people, sailed from France with over 4,500 Holocaust survivors and crew. They were all Jewish, except Reverend John Grauel. During the voyage, the British Navy shadowed these homeless, unarmed men, women, and children. Conditions on board were terrible. There was severe seasickness, heat, food and water problems, and diarrhea. Health concerns soon overloaded the sanitary facilities. More than 400 pregnant women were on board. And at dawn of the second morning, the loudspeaker announced, "Our first child has been born. Mother and child are in excellent health." July the 17th, 1947, as the Warfield sailed off the Sinai coast, she was officially given her new name, the Exodus 1947. Now, the timing of the operation was no coincidence. The Holocaust refugees arrived in Palestine by design at the very moment when UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Committee, was conducting its fact-finding mission here. Grauel penned an appeal that was broadcast from the ship, directed to UNSCOP. The members were staying in Beit Kadima, the residential complex near Kiryat Shmuel, originally built to house the families of British officers. "Gentlemen," they were all men, I'm sorry, At this time, we request that you appear to gather testimony from the 4,500 Jews who are coming to Palestine in a few hours aboard the Exodus 1947. We remind you that no committee was called to witness the death of 6 million Jews in Europe. This is your opportunity to fulfill the requirements of your declared justice in these matters. Witness, if you will, the heartache, the sorrow, and the suffering, and the utter brutality inflicted on our people by the British. You have declared yourselves to guarantee equal opportunity to all who seek freedom. Bear witness in truth to that declaration and hear our case now. That night, the Exodus was rammed by the British. Everyone was thrown to the deck. Tear gas grenades were exploding. Marines boarded the Exodus, clubbing everyone in sight. The deck was littered with wounded and dead, and with water pouring into the ship, the captain ordered a ceasefire. Over 200 people were wounded, and 3 people lay dead. As the Exodus limped into Haifa, hundreds of British police and soldiers crowded the area. Witnessing the scene in Haifa was the UNSCOP chairman, Sweden's Carl Sandstrom. And now we understand the role of Reverend Growl. He deliberately attracted British attention. He was arrested, taken off the ship, nobody else was, to a police station, interrogated, sent under house arrest to Haifa's Savoy Hotel. He arrives at the hotel and the desk clerk whispers to him that the bar is full of reporters. So before the British police escort can stop him, he makes a dash into the bar. Now the British had kept news of the Exodus under wraps. Recognizing some journalists that he knew, Growl announces at the top of his voice, "I'm from the Exodus." And the flash bulbs were popping, and he was hemmed in all around by reporters. The Haganah knew that a Jew reporting from the Exodus would be regarded as biased and as suspect. They also knew that the word of a Christian clergyman would be believed. And of course, the Haganah was not. In the middle of the melee in the bar, the Haganah spirited Growl out the back door to a safe house in Haifa, and the next morning, while the British were searching for him in Haifa, he arrived here in Jerusalem in Beit Kadima, where he met Dr. Ralph Bunch, that's a name that some of you will be aware of, and other United Nations officials, and UNSCOP members, including Judge Ivan Rand from Canada. They quizzed Growl about where the Exodus was attacked. Growl had the ship's log to prove that the Exodus had not been in British territorial waters when it was boarded. He also emphasized that there wasn't a single weapon aboard the Exodus. Growl told them, "I have watched these people. I know what they are, and I tell you, the Jews in the European displaced persons camps insist on coming to Palestine. They will come to Palestine. And nothing short of open warfare and complete destruction will halt them." Ladies and gentlemen, it is time to introduce our fourth and final Christian clergyman of the evening. Normally, in Ireland, in Britain, and even when I addressed the Jewish Historical Society in Jerusalem a couple of months back, this is the point where I say, if Growl is obscure, Reverend William Lovell Hull is even more so. But of course, for you, he may be the least obscure of the four. Because, of course, it's Hull and his wife Lillian moved here from Canada in 1935 after Hull received a call from God. He founded the non-denominational Zion Apostolic Mission, later, of course, to become the Zion Christian Mission. The Hulls opened a little Bible shop, which only closed in 1989, if I'm not mistaken, because of rezoning issues. That's 50 years the little Bible shop survived. Now, a couple of minutes ago, I mentioned that among the UNSCOP delegates who met John Growl in Jerusalem was Canada's representative, Justice Ivan C. Rand of the Canadian Supreme Court. Rand knew very little about Palestine, the Jews, or the urgent necessity for Holocaust survivors to come here. Britain had pushed for Canada to join that committee on the assumption that as a Commonwealth member, Canada would recognize that the Balfour Declaration was the source of the problems of Palestine. Britain fully expected Rand and Unscop to recommend a simple amendment to the terms of the British mandate and to formalize Jewish immigration restrictions. The Canadian Department of External Affairs was concerned that, God forbid, Rand should not be too influenced by the Holocaust. So to balance the picture, they gave Rand a briefing paper that equated the Holocaust with the killing of hundreds of thousands of Muslims by the Mongols in Baghdad in 1258. When Rand arrived here from Canada, it was only natural that he would search out a fellow countryman, which is how he met Reverend Hull, who became Rand's unofficial advisor. There is no doubt about how much Hull influenced Rand. Rand wrote a book called The Fall and Rise of Israel, The Story of the Jewish People During the Time of Their Dispersal and Regathering. And Rand wrote the foreword. This is in the early 50s. And this is what Rand wrote in the foreword of Hull's book. It was a relief then when shortly after my arrival I had the good fortune to meet the author of this book. Here he was, a Canadian, a clergyman, a man of goodwill, well known too, and knowing the many religious and racial groups in that amazing galaxy of rivalries and antagonisms. Here, I thought, was one whom I could trust to express himself with honesty and frankness. Somewhat to my surprise, I listened to words of high admiration of the Jewish people, their standards of life, and tremendous work they had done since returning to their ancient homeland. Unscop left Palestine at the end of July 1947 and convened in Geneva to write their report. The committee was deadlocked. Various ideas on the table, not enough support from any group within the committee. Until Rand, clearly influenced by Reverend Growl and Reverend Hull, decided he owed more allegiance to the United Nations than to Canada, or Britain for that matter. Rand put forward a proposal advocating partition, in other words, the establishment of an independent Jewish state. I'm sure many of you know the play and the movie 12 Angry Men, which starts with the murder trial, the jury convenes, and the foreman of the jury says, listen guys, he says, we want to get home tonight, don't want to mess around, a quick poll. Let's decide he's guilty, we can go home. See, there's a quick poll, guilty, 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 guilty. It's the last person, he says, I don't know. And everyone's yelling at him, aren't you hungry, don't you miss your home, don't you want to go home? He says, I don't know. And of course, the film and the play, the story is, eventually, one by one, he convinces all of them to have enough doubt about the guilt of the guy accused of murder for them to say not guilty. Rand gradually convinces a majority of his colleagues to support him. He reaffirmed the legality of the Balfour Declaration, and he stressed that it was the 1939 British White Paper, with its restrictive limits on Jewish immigration, that was the illegal document and the real source of the problems in Palestine. By a vote of 7-3, Unscop endorsed Rand's partition plan. A couple of months later, many of us know the date, when the General Assembly met in Flushing Meadow on the 29th of November, Kaftetma November 1947, to vote on Resolution 181, which recommended the partition of Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state, the vote was 33 in favor, 13 against, and by the two-thirds majority rule, it was passed. I have no doubt that Unscop's recommendation for partition crucially swung the balance, because I find it very unlikely that if Unscop had not recommended partition, that the United Nations General Assembly would have gone against the UNSCOP recommendation. In his book, Hull describes the scene in Jerusalem. It was after midnight when the result of the crucial vote was heard over the air from New York. Sleep fled, the street was full of righteous sound, but a riot of joy. Trucks passed full of young and old, singing, shouting, waving flags, blowing trumpets, and above all rang out the triumphant cry, Medinat HaYehudim, this is his words, Medinat HaYehudim, a Jewish state. Describing Ben-Gurion's pronouncement of statehood several months later, Hull wrote, after 2,000 years of longing, hoping, suffering, praying, the state of Israel was born. Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, for keeping us alive, preserving us, and permitting us to attain this day, Shechiyanu, Vikimanu, Vihigiyanu, Lazman Hazeh. Ladies and gentlemen, I've almost completed my talk on the four Christian clergymen who had such a major impact on helping the Jews come home. Before I close, allow me to briefly describe what happened to my four protagonists, whom I call God's little errand boys. And the reason I call them God's little errand boys is that Reverend Blackstone himself called himself God's little errand boy. This was too good of an opportunity to miss, so I took a little poetic license here, and I made that the name of the book. By the way, the book also includes chapters on non-clergymen errand boys, the American soil and water experts Elwood Mead and Walter Clay Loudermilk, but they are the subject of a separate talk. Blackstone was honored by the American Zionists, who described him as the father of Zionism. Not Herzl. They call Blackstone the father of Zionism. He died in 1935 and is buried in California. Reverend Heschler continued speaking out against anti-Semitism and in favor of the Zionist dream. When he retired and returned to Britain, the Zionist executive provided him with a small monthly pension, but he died in obscurity in 1931 and was buried in an unmarked grave in London's New Southgate Cemetery. In 2010, my friend Jerry Klinger, and I have at least one person in the audience who knows Jerry Klinger, of the Jewish American Society for Historic Preservation, found a copy of Heschler's death certificate, and he found the gravesite with the help of Reverend David Pileggi, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, a passionate Heschler scholar and rector of Christ Church here in Jerusalem. Through the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem, Klinger got support from Christian organizations and from the British Jewish community. And a year ago, a small and moving ceremony was held to dedicate a memorial stone for Reverend William Heschler in New Southgate Cemetery. And a letter from Ron Prosser, then Israel's ambassador to the UK, was read out. And here's what he said. Marking Reverend Heschler's prominent place in the rich tradition of Christian Zionism in Britain on the 80th anniversary of his passing is especially timely. The support he gave to Theodor Herzl is symbolic of the understanding that is found today among our Christian friends of the eternal connection that exists between the Jewish people and Eretz Israel. The people of Israel deeply value your solidarity. You are friends who stand with us as we face the challenges of the future, who share with us a love of the Holy Land. Like Heschler, Graul remained a lifelong Zionist and was a frequent visitor to Israel. He came across a very innovative way of visiting Israel. Every time he fancied coming to visit here, he managed to get himself a job as a chaplain on a Zim passenger ship. The State of Israel awarded him the Humanity Medal, the Fighter for Israel Medal, and the Medal of Jerusalem. He died in New Jersey in 1986, and as he requested in his will, he was buried with full Israeli naval military honors. His funeral was attended by crew members of the Exodus. And where is he buried? Right here in the American Christian Missionary Alliance Cemetery on Emek Rephaim Street. As you probably know, some of you, Hebrew does not distinguish between Catholic and Protestant clergyman. So on his gravestone, it says, John the priest, which is a translation of the Hebrew, Yochanan HaKomer. Now, of course, he actually wasn't a Komer. He wasn't a Catholic priest. But Hebrew hasn't caught up yet. It's only a few hundred years since the Reformation, so give us time. And on his gravestone is that wonderful Talmudic verse, whosoever preserves a single soul of Israel, Scripture ascribes to him as if he had preserved a complete world. There is a fascinating postscript to our fourth clergyman, your own William Hull. In 1961, as he was coming to the end of more than a quarter of a century in Jerusalem, he received a very unusual request from the Israeli Ministry of Religious Affairs. Would he agree to be the spiritual advisor to a Christian prisoner? Yes, says Hull. By the way, he was told, the prisoner is on death row. Well, the only prisoner ever to be on death row in Israel was, of course, Adolf Eichmann, who had been found guilty of war crimes in a trial whose 50th anniversary we commemorated last year. And over a period of 50 days in 1962, Hull held 14 interviews with Eichmann in his death cell in Ramleh prison. Hull witnessed the execution and later went out to sea to spread Eichmann's ashes. He also wrote a book about his conversations with Eichmann. Hull returned to Canada in 1962, and it is a special thrill for me to give this talk in the community that he helped to found. And Hull died in 1992. My friends, I began this evening by asking why I should be interested in Christians who support Israel. It would be flying in the face of history if anyone tried to gloss over the troubled legacy of Christian antisemitism. Last month, I addressed a conference in Ireland on the subject of 2,000 years of church antisemitism. But it would be equally wrong to ignore the few bright spots. One bright spot, of course, is the thousands of Christians who saved Jews during the Holocaust, what we call the righteous among the nations, 99.99% of whom were Christians. And another bright spot is those Christians, individuals and organizations, who have stood by Israel before, during, and since independence. I hope that my talks and my books go some way to acknowledging and honoring those Christian heroes who made it their mission to help the Jews come home. My friends, thank you very much. The floor is yours. I'm happy to answer any questions, or attempt to anyway. Just, I've stunned you into silence. Go on, Chuck, you ask a question.
Since you mentioned Reverend David Pelleggi, he's here, I'd like you to respond. Come on up, David. Don't be shy.
Oh wow, what a thrill.
And then we'll go to the questions.
That is so like you. How did I know that?
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Wow.
You know Jerry Klinger then.
I do know Jerry Klinger. How to respond to this? Well, first of all, thank you very much for your wonderful, inspiring lecture. And it's a huge, huge topic. It's under the Christian interest and Christian support for the Jewish people is certainly very controversial at this moment. So I just would like to say few words about Heschler to show everybody, if I may, just I need about a half a minute, and I'll give you the spotlight back, to show you what happened to Heschler after he died and what's happened to him now. And it sort of traces the, maybe by just looking at his life and how people understood him, it sort of traces the attitude of the public towards these folks. So when Heschler died, it was true, he was pretty much forgotten. He did get a pension from the Zionist movement. And afterwards, after his death, they thought a little bit, maybe for about 5 minutes. This is the Jewish Agency for Palestine. Well, maybe we should have a memorial to this man who did so much. Then they thought, no, he was a little bit too eccentric. And besides, he may have had a little bit of some kind of connection, which he did not, in the conversion of Hans Herzl to Christianity. So he was largely forgotten. And when people started to write biographies of Theodor Herzl, especially those people who did not know him in a second and third generation after Herzl, he was thought to be a clown, okay, an eccentric, a charlatan. And you can read Herzl's Jewish biographers, and they don't pay him a lot of they don't give him a lot of credit, and he doesn't get a lot of attention, and he certainly doesn't get any good press. So he went from being ignored to being sort of a useful village idiot. All right, and you can, whether it's Amos Elon or I can't think of, because I'm getting old, I can't think of all the biographies, but there are a number of really good, decent biographies written about Herzl. Heschler's always the dramatic clown. He's the comic relief of the story. And nowadays, Heschler, William Heschler, after a while, William Heschler in the 80s and 90s was adopted by the Christian Zionist, who thought he was some kind of a genius and some kind of a great mastermind. And so he went from being the village idiot to being, you know, the guy who did absolutely everything for Herzl. So you can see where the swing has gone. Not that too many people know that much about him, but still they're all waiting for my book. So, anyway. And so people began to repeat these generalizations. And so he became sort of a superhero, you know, a guy who kind of did everything, kind of left poor Herzl in the cold. And finally, what happens is today he's become a sinister, evil person, because now he's being attacked by the anti-Zionist. And, of course, now he is responsible for the State of Israel, and he is the father of Christian Zionism. And if you read some folks on the Internet, he was in a plot with the British government, you know, to take over the Palestine on behalf of Britain. And he has just become, you know, the worst thing since HIV, okay? So in just a few, you can just look at how people have reacted to Heschler to see that he's gone from being ignored to being an idiot, kind of a useful idiot, to being some superhero. And today, if you read the works of people like Steven Sizer and others, well, he's just a pretty horrible guy. And I guess this sums up the attitude people have towards Christian supporters of Israel. Boss, I'm really sorry to steal all of your time, but I just thought I would put in a plug for my man.
I've been writing about this guy and talking about this guy, and to meet him in person is wow, that's brilliant. So, and thank you for not telling me in advance. I may have stuttered. Good, because I may have stuttered more tonight. So, please, my friends, comments, questions, anything that grabs you. Don't be shy. If I don't know, I'll tell you. I'll say, ask David. Yes.
I don't know, I could talk a long time over. I'm also actually a lawyer, but I have a Berliner. I escaped from Nazi.
And my grandfather knew Theodore Herzl personally.
Wow.
I believe that also God heard our prayers next year in Jerusalem. To this very day, I believe God hears the prayers of us Jewish people. He always has. He has never changed. And I believe he's all credit due to these Christians. I've been personally, verbally and physically assaulted by so-called Christians. And I've lived through all this. I was in England and I saw on the news, past news, when I went to the cinema about the Exodus. It's been part of my life. But I thank God I'm still alive today and in the land of our forefathers. That's all I have to say. But just, I think you answered the question, or maybe you're probably wise. My grandfather, who was one of the most well-known rabbis in Germany, Berlin, the Hohenburger Straße, do you know it? You know it's in the Gorge.
Yes, I have. My father would know it.
The Neue Synagoge, the Wulgeburger Straße. And he came here in 1912. I've got a copy in English of the lecture he gave here. And I think you've asked the question why he came and when he spoke about it. Besides what I've got.
Love to see that lecture.
Thank
you, and thank you for those very inspiring thoughts, and they drive me too. I'm motivated by very similar thoughts. Thank you. Yes, anyone? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just want to give a good thank you for where you come. It's partly through this help that I'm here in Israel, way back.
Wow. Was it on Hanavim Street at some point?
That Zion bookshop had many, many blessings.
Wonderful.
I remember so much his preaching here and living too many times.
Wow.
And I give all the credit to him and for his work he did with I had the book on that, how he was preaching all the time to me. And the fact that the government helped him to do it, I think that was amazing.
Well, I have to say, of all the four, I knew about Blackstone, and I knew about Heschler. And I'd even mentioned both of them in the book that came before in my Six Officers book. I only heard about Growl from my friend Jerry Klinger, and that made me start inquiring more. Then I learned about what Jerry had done for Herzl. And through that, I found out about Hull and rejoiced in the fact, and this is before I knew you guys, or that there was an organic connection between him having been here and anything that's still here now. I just rejoiced in the fact that I'd found somebody that I really truly believe that his impact is incalculable. If he hadn't turned the Judge Rand's mind about what was going on and what the real situation was, I really don't know whether that subcommittee, the UNSCOP committee, would ever have been able to come up with a majority vote in favor of partition. And as I said, I have my doubts as to whether, if that committee had not brought a recommendation to Flushing Meadow, whether the partition proposal would have got its two-third majority. And I feel that of all the four, Hull was the clincher, because it was that vote in Geneva. Argy-bargy, there were factions, and the Indians had a motion, and the Swedish guy, Sandström, seems to have been a bit of a, in English it's a bit of a wally, he didn't carry very much weight. And Rand just moved in there, and using his legal brain, he put forward a proposal that was not wishy-washy. It was very specific. Jewish state, and that the white paper is the problem, not the Balfour Declaration. So by saying that the Balfour Declaration is where we start in our recommendation, it was a whole different sort of proposal that was brought to the floor of the United Nations. So I've always felt, ever since I heard about him, that he might be the most obscure of the four, but chronologically, he probably was the linchpin on that critical UNSCOP vote. And so, Reverend Hull, I thank you. Thank you. And then I'll make a note of all the books being available.
I might say that my grandfather believed in the founding of the state before it happened. And he had to come in 1952 to see what he had always dreamed and preached about and taught about in his church as a pastor. So that's why I'm here. And I was born on May 14th, 1948. So that's my claim to fame.
My wife and I went to the Hebrew University 16 years ago, and we said, you're training people in medicine and agriculture. How come you're not training Bible translators? And so for the last 16 years, there's been a special program at the Hebrew University bringing Bible translators from around the world to learn the language of the Bible in the land of the Bible. And so in 16 years, we've had some 99 students from 35 different countries speaking 60 different languages that in another 15 or 20 years will have a Bible in their mother tongue, and they will be able to read about Shivat Zion. Because if there's almost 7,000 languages in the world and there are only 461 translations of the Tanakh, how are they going to get excited about Shivat Zion? And so my contribution would be the kind of thing that I say to Christian pilgrim and study groups, that the New Testament for us is obviously important, but it's like a flower. It's like a beautiful flowering of God's love. God loved the Jewish people so much he gave them the Torah in writing in Moses, and then figured out that they're not all of them getting it the way they should. I better live it out in somebody's life. And so he came as Emmanuel. But I've got some slogans, because I'm also a tour guide, that just look in the New Testament. In the Gospels alone, it says Scriptures 24 times. It says it is written 48 times. It's double that in the whole New Testament. And what are they talking about? The Tanakh. Jesus' Bible. So that's one of my slogans. The Tanakh is Jesus' Bible. And if he respected it, we better respect it. And if Christianity in our minds is like the flowering of God's love that was too big just for the Jewish people, but there to be a light to the nations, to us barbarians as well. I'm Norwegian barbarian background Viking.
Hey, you did naughty things in Ireland.
Yes. In the prayer book, it says, preserve us from the fury of the Northmen. That's my ancestry.
You have been warned.
So I tell them, look, if you cut our Christian faith from its roots in Jesus' Bible, you've got a beautiful flower, and it looks beautiful for a little while, but then it wilts. And if you just leave it there, it rots and it stinks. And that's Christianity without our roots, without the grand sweep from creation till the end of time. So that would be, if we don't hang on to our Jewish heritage, you have things like what happened in Europe.
Yes, sir.
When you speak in before Jewish audiences about, especially your last book, I'm sure you get the question posed to you about, well, aren't these people really just motivated by sinister motivations? Aren't they out to either convert all of us, or don't they really see an apocalyptic outcome, Armageddon?
Yeah.
Isn't it just about this chessboard?
Well, maybe it's something about me. Those people, for some reason, don't turn up to my lectures. However, of course, I know about them. I acknowledge their existence. And I have a very an answer that satisfies me. I can't be sure what it does to them, but obviously you cannot get into this field and start, and I've tried to do some study of my own and research into the 19th century, rich with all these Christians popping up everywhere, doing amazing, saying amazing things, like more Zionist than the Zionists. And so you can't do that without that question coming up. And I suppose my answer is as honest as I can come up with. My wish to acknowledge what I call Christian heroes. For me, a Christian hero is somebody who did something in his or her life that helped the Jews come home. It's a very simple mantra, and it's not a complicated one. And hopefully it's not even too political. This is what motivates me, as the gentleman was saying. The ins and outs of theology. What turns people's wheels? What part of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, what part they play, particular verses and understanding of verses and seeing cross-references and all of the above. Theology is always, in my opinion, something between a person and his or her maker. Theology, the relationship between man or mankind and God. I'm not a theologian, not a rabbi. I get called rabbi sometimes, but I'm not. I don't get into that. Judaism is actually more of a faith based on what you do rather than what you think. In Judaism, you can think what you like and you'll never be prosecuted. You'll be prosecuted for doing things that aren't right. I use that criterion for judging other people too. If a Christian stands up and says, I am in favor of the state of Israel, or I am against the delegitimization of the state of Israel, and I acknowledge the right of the Jewish people to come back to their home, I don't ask for more than that, and I don't need more than that, and I certainly don't go digging to find out anything else, because I'm not interested. What I'm interested in is what they do and what they stand up and say. What people's beliefs are, whether they're Jewish beliefs, Christian beliefs, and the whole spectrum of Jewish and Christian beliefs, I don't go there. I don't need to go there. I do feel, and I have said this earlier in the evening, and I write it in my books, and that is what is driving my passion for the last few years. I do believe there are Christian heroes like Colonel Patterson, and like Ord Wingate, and like my four clergymen and the two agriculturalists, fascinating American soil and water experts who did amazing work in changing hearts and minds at critical point between the two wars and after. They are the people that I believe Jews need to honor more and Christians need to know more about. And so, happily, my field of interest appeals across both faiths. And I'm very happy with that, which is why I don't change my talk when I'm talking to a Christian audience or a Jewish audience. If I'm in Manchester, or Liverpool, or Jerusalem, or Athlone, or Limerick, or Dublin. And I think that maybe is the answer to your question.
In your assessment, their concern for Jews was sincere beyond
I go by what they did. If someone gets 416 of the most prominent Americans alive to sign a document saying, bring the Jews back to Palestine, in Hebrew they say, Dayenu. That's fine with me. And that is really, that's what I'm interested in. And if there are undertones, overtones or whatever, again, as they would say, Gesundheit. That, you know, I mean that. That's not my, I don't feel the need to go there. That's private. I judge a person by their deeds. And for a beleaguered country like Israel is, and a beleaguered people, you count very carefully who stands up and says, we believe that there should be a state of Israel. Without going into any of the modern politics, and I deliberately, in all my talks, stop in 1948. That's my safety zone. I talk about the establishment of the state of Israel, and I deliberately don't talk about anything since then so as not to get into politics. This is not about politics. This is historical roots, aspects of Jewish, Christian, Zionist history that people don't know about. So I want to talk about Patterson and Ord Wingate and Meinertshagen and other people I've got lined up, because obviously I can't stop, so there'll be more. I'm always searching for more and more. I came across somebody else now that very interesting, and that's what I see that as my contribution. My small contribution to a better understanding among both peoples of what individual Christians did to help the Jews come home. So thank you for the question. Please. And here. Yeah.
Why this was built, this is Wilhelm II, is that right? Why?
Third.
The third. Why would he even acknowledge him if he's getting land, et cetera, from the Ottoman Empire? I mean, he got the stuff up on top of,
Okay. It's true that once Wilhelm decided to come to Christchurch and on the way pay his respects, we're talking about a massive entourage, to go to see the Sultan, clearly he wasn't looking for trouble. However, he was persuaded by the Duke of Baden and other people in his court that he ought to meet this Dr. Herzl. And politics is a very fluid thing. And we know that the Germany of the late 19th century had distinct empire dreams. And Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, was known for hundreds of years as the sick man of Europe. Everyone had been predicting the demise of that empire for centuries. And it was clear by the late 19th century that it wouldn't last. And then, of course, they made the wrong decision in the early days of First World War, when they, thank you very much, when they threw their lot in with Germany. Had they thrown their lot in with Britain, things would have been very different, but they couldn't do that because Britain was allied to Russia and Turkey would never be an ally of Russia. So that's the background. So I don't think the Kaiser led Herzl on. I think that he was prepared to meet him, A, because he was being pressured to do so, and he was not immune from the wave of the Jews should go home that was sweeping across Europe. It was mainly England, but it was also in Germany. Heschler was in Germany when he was in Austria. So he agreed to meet him, and he made a political decision to make this a public meeting. A public meeting meant that the Daily Mail could make that report and say, wow, the Kaiser has met Dr. Herzl in public, and this has an implication that Dr. Herzl has now acknowledged. The Zionist movement was tiny, pitsy. It was very small. And this recognition by the Kaiser was what, don't forget, it's what Herzl had asked for. Now, the world of geopolitics being what it is, the Kaiser couldn't deliver. He got over his disappointment and started looking elsewhere. And that's when the British colonial secretary came to him and said, Dr. Herzl, I've got just the place for you. It's in Uganda. And this caused convulsions in the Zionist movement. And although Herzl himself didn't think it was a good idea, he didn't want to split in the movement, and so he said, okay, we will send a delegation to go and examine it. And he's vilified for having agreed to send a delegation. The delegation took one look at Uganda and said, not on your Nelly. No, in no way, this is just not, it's not going to happen. But, so, look, you know, the Kaiser wouldn't be the first politician in history to try and play at both sides. And I'm sure that's what happened. But I think that at first he agreed to meet him, and I think in general he thought, yeah, not a bad idea, but, second thoughts, I am not going to be the pioneer here. And happily, of course, a different empire, the British Empire, stepped into the breach. I hope that answers the question. Yes, sir.
Just a hypothetical question of opinion. If the state of Israel had not been created in 1948, do you think it would be possible today for the state of Israel to emerge?
Today? Must be joking. The only way you could do it today is if you spice the drink of 170 nations at the United Nations and just get the others. No, seriously, no way.
Would you see the emergence of 1948 as a divine act?
Again, I try to leave theology to individuals. Oh, and I mean that. There is no doubt in my mind that the convergence of several different historical strands, and I don't believe in coincidences, if that's an answer. The movement that started in earnest, well, the movement started 2,000 years ago as soon as the Jews were dispossessed here by the Romans. And they never, ever forgot or lost sight of where they belonged. Never. It's a famous story. Jabotinsky came to Ireland just before the war, and the Jewish Lord Mayor, or the future Jewish Lord Mayor, Briscoe, managed to get a meeting between Jabotinsky and de Valera, the Irish Taoiseach, the Irish Prime Minister at the time. And de Valera said to Jabotinsky, he said, listen, he said, what is this Zionist thing? Go find another place. Go somewhere else. I'm sure we'll find you somewhere else where you can go. So Jabotinsky said to de Valera, what would have happened if the plague had wiped out everybody in Ireland? No one left in Ireland. Would Irish people outside of Ireland have said, oh well, no more Ireland, that's it. We'll, forget Ireland. So de Valera said, don't be stupid. Of course not. Ireland is will always be. So Jabotinsky said, yeah, well, Israel has always been ours. We've always prayed for it. We've always thought about it. We've always spoken about it. We've said every Pesach, L'shana ba'a b'Yerushalayim, and we meant it. So there is no doubt that the movement that started 2,000 years ago got a lot of traction during the 19th century, thanks very much to individual Christians who started making this open, demanding. Look at Blackstone, look at the language. It could have come out of yesterday's Jerusalem Post, his words. Astonishing. Clear as a bell. Stating what he wanted and why. I didn't even read the whole of the Blackstone memorial. And then, of course, the tragedy of the Holocaust. I have a big problem with President Obama's Cairo speech from 3 years ago, because he said in that speech something which I believe to be historically and factually wrong. He said, the state of Israel was created out of the ashes of the Holocaust. No, it wasn't. Yes, it happened 3 years after the Holocaust. And it happened partly because we had the remnants from the concentration camps trying to get here, and the British said, you can't come in. But the story of the State of Israel, the Balfour Declaration, was a little before the Holocaust. So, and I think that's also important. So I do see the convergence of all these things coming together, and thanks in no small measure to the actions of our four clergymen from this evening, that everything came together in one critical moment of huge historical importance. Thank you. Yes, wasn't it? Yes, yes, that's right. In the caves. Well, thankfully, a lot of them are doing just that. Commercial break. You may have noticed I do have a few books for sale here. I've only got very few of the vow and of the six offices, but this evening's talk, of course, much expanded, is here in God's Little Errand Boys, 75 shekel. I was in Jerusalem a couple of months ago, and without thinking, I said, 75 euro a book. Which is a bit more than, yes. Anyway, so it's 75 shekel a book. Any more questions? Not yet, but I am working on it.
Are you going to translate
it? Yes, I am. Yes, I do that. One of my many tricks. I don't know when or how that's going to happen, because I don't translate that direction. I do the other way around. But I'd love it to be translated into Hebrew. I would. I also, a friend of mine, an Israeli who lives in Dublin, he read this one. And he said to me that he wants to find a sponsor to translate this into Hebrew and to force every single Israeli school child to read this, because he says there's stuff there that none of them have ever heard about, and they should. So I'd be very happy to accommodate that. Oh, absolutely, and he gets a special mention in the books as well. Remarkable man. It's funny, I was just talking to my grandson this morning about that. I was taking him to school from Petach Tikva to Kiryat Ono, and I don't know how the subject came up. So I said to him, what would we be speaking here today if Ben Yehuda hadn't been so bloody stubborn? And so we discussed it, and we came to the conclusion that we'd be speaking either Russian, Yiddish, English, Turkish, Arabic, anything but the modernized, revitalized, re-energized language of Hebrew. Absolutely. Okay. I reckon we've come to the a natural end to the evening. I want to thank you all very much for turning up in this amazing weather. Gishmei bracha. I think of the water levels. I once told an audience to get some idea of what it's like in Israel. I said, it's the only country in the world, I think, where on the front page of the newspaper, almost every day of the year, there'd be something to do with water. the Kinneret, the level, desalination or whatever. And so I don't mind this weather. First of all, it reminds me of Ireland, so I'm fine. So thank you again very much. Lovely meeting you. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me.